The Michael Brown Show on Talk Radio 630 KHOW.
Hey, welcome back to the Michael Brown Show. Glad to have you with me in the studio. Now, we're doing our gubernatorial candidate interviews this week, and we just finished talking to Greg Brophy. Mike Copps in the studio. Just as a reminder, tomorrow at 4, we'll have Scott Gessler. 5 o'clock, Tom Tancredo. On Wednesday at 5, we'll have Bob Beaupre. Thursday at 5, we'll have Steve House. So, let me just say, Mr. Copps, nice to meet you.
Well, it is good to meet you.
I don't know that you and I have ever met before.
I think we met across a crowded room one time, Michael.
Good Lord. One of those things?
There was no smoke, though.
I'm sorry to say that. Oh, Lord. So one of the things that I was hoping to accomplish in these interviews is, one, really kind of pin you down on a few issues. But before we get there, the other thing I wanted to accomplish was most people, and I know you're out pounding the pavement, but most people don't really get to know a candidate on a real personal basis. So other than the fact you got on a nice green check shirt today, and everybody that knows you has told me what a nice guy you are, and you dress well and you look well, would you tell me who the hell you are? I mean, who are you really?
I would be I'd be glad to. Thanks again for the opportunity. Well, I think the most important thing about me that people ought to know about is I'm married to an amazing woman named Shannon. And I don't mean that in jest. I mean that sincerely. I believe that the family is at the center of society. I think what Ronald Reagan said is true, that all great change in America starts at the dinner table. I have 4 wonderful kids. I'd been married before, and people now and then bring this subject up. I lost my wife to cancer, and so I left the Senate. I was serving in the state Senate at the time, and I had this incredibly...
And people should know that's why you left.
Right. Because I've got, you know, 4 amazing kids.
Right.
Shannon is an angel, and I mean that sincerely. When we began dating, I actually kept asking her, are you an angel? And you asked what people ought to know about me. I think people ought to know how these candidates tick. And the fact of the matter is, I feel like Shannon came in and saved me and gave me and my kids a new and incredible outlook for the future. We could embrace the potential and the opportunities of the future in a way that, frankly, I didn't know was possible. I didn't know that at all. We met at a political breakfast, of all things, and she fell instantly in love with me. She couldn't help herself. Actually, the fact of the matter is it took me about 6 weeks to work up some courage.
Well, ching, there's the first lie of the day.
Right. Yeah, everybody that knows us would know that's not true. It took me about 6 weeks to work up the courage to ask Shannon out, and she relented, and she did begin dating me, and then I introduced her to the kids, which was scary for me because there's a lot of them. There's 4 of them, and Shannon did not have kids and had not been married, and so this was when I said this woman was an angel, I mean that sincerely. She's an amazing woman. I grew up in South Dakota, and I grew up riding bulls and hunting deer and occasionally hunting pheasants because they were on the other side of the state from where I grew up. And my dad was a career forester. My mom was a church secretary. And so I grew up in a home that valued service and public service. I guess it's not a surprise that when I graduated high school, which was in 1987, I went to work for Ronald Reagan, is how I like to say it. Actually, I joined the 82nd Airborne Division and began jumping out of perfectly good airplanes. And I share this story sometimes, but a defining moment in my life was when Ronald Reagan sent my unit of the 82nd Airborne Division to parachute into Honduras. I don't know if you remember Operation Golden Pheasant.
Yeah.
And we stood on the parade field, and our commanding general came out and he spoke with us, and he said, "Men, if any of you want to step out of formation right now, you don't have to go do this jump." We didn't know what we were going to get into. And the reason that was an appealing option for me is because I'd been in my unit for 2 weeks. I hadn't even made a single jump with the 82nd Airborne Division yet. I was smart enough to know I didn't know anything at the time. I didn't get out of formation, and I think that changed me forever. I made that jump. I was very proud of my military service. I went on to become a Ranger and served in the 82nd Airborne Division, had the opportunity to serve in the Gulf War. when I got out, my father had been a career forester, and I got out and I began to fight fires. Actually, I thought I would pursue that as a career option. And I decided, and I became a hotshot. The one time I ran for my life was on a wildfire in Idaho. I became a hotshot firefighter, and I made a pretty dramatic change in my personal life, and I went into ministry work. I became a pastor. For 7 years, I was committed to that course, and really invested myself in trying to help people.
And this is why I love asking these "who are you" questions. That moment to move into the ministry, were you on the fire line?
In a way, yes. Truthfully, there were two moments that I remember. One was when I was still in the Army, and I was sitting on a parade field, essentially, and we were waiting to load our airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember watching a sergeant major walk around and bark orders to guys for their haircuts, which is military discipline is obviously very important. But at that moment, I looked ahead and I said, "That's my future." And it wasn't that it was the wrong future, and it's a perfectly honorable one, but I looked at it and it just did not feel like I could see myself in that future. And so I became open to this idea that there was something I wanted to do that was different and maybe broader. I just felt that kind of internal gnawing. And I was on a fire line in Idaho, and I looked down the line and I saw this man that was probably about the age that I am right now. So I was early 20s, and this guy was 30 years old like me and devilishly handsome. Actually, he's probably 45, like I am, somewhere in there. And I looked down, and again, wonderful career. And I looked down, and I said, "That's not what I want to do. That's not what I want to do. I thought I did, but I didn't want to do it." So those were really baked in as kind of a backdrop to the decision that I ultimately made to go into ministry work.
I've just been on a couple of those fire lines, and it amazes me how, and you just perfectly described it, because the first time I was on a fire line, and I know this is not part of the interview.
Where was that?
It was probably in one of the wildfires in Montana back in the mid-2000s when I was the undersecretary. And, I went in with a team just because I wanted to experience and really, tell the guys thanks. And the most shocking thing to me was, yes, it was the heat and the smoke and the danger and all of that, but was looking up and down that line and realizing, I'm the old fart. All these guys that are out there doing it are 18, 19, 20 years old. It's like, holy cow. It was an amazing experience for me.
Yeah, you know what it looks like to look down that line. It's a lot of people working very hard. It's a very dangerous environment. And, it's the angel's work. It's difficult stuff, for sure. It's for the young.
Yeah, oh yeah, absolutely. So how long were you in the ministry?
7 years. 7 years as a pastor, and then I went into ministry work in a different form. After that, I worked for an outfit that trained pastors and ministry leaders around the world and around the country, and so I did that for a few years, both as a kind of an employee. You raise your own funds to work for them. You can raise whatever salary you want as long as you raise it. You can have whatever salary you want as long as you raise it. And then I did a lot of my work as fee-for-service consulting, which led into doing small business work for myself, helping nonprofits do a lot of the same kinds of capacity building, fundraising, and those types of things.
So there's a point in this timeline, this chronology that you're describing, where something snapped in your head and you said, "I'm going to run for public office."
Yeah.
What was that?
Well, this is the truth of the matter. I would run home from school when I was 7, 8 years old, and I would wait for the airing of World News Tonight. And I don't know why. I didn't pay attention to the local news. I liked to watch what was going on in the bigger world, and I watched it all the time. And I look back at that, and I think, why would a young kid want to do that? I was very young. And then as I got a little older, I was immediately drawn to Ronald Reagan. My dad probably had a lot to do with that, because my father was a big fan of Ronald Reagan and a strong military and very much a patriot and very much in favor of Israel, very pro-Israel. That's the household I grew up in. And then you have this public service backdrop to all of that. So I began to be really interested for the first time in serving in political office, and I think it sort of resurrected some of those, it kind of grew some of those early seeds that I felt kind of started planting in my life at a young age in about the year 2000. I was reading a political book, and it doesn't necessarily matter the book it was. It happened to be a book of letters that George H.W. Bush published. It was his what he counted as his memoirs. I don't know if you've read those letters.
Book, right.
Yeah, and I, for no particular reason, it struck me that serving in public life is an opportunity to apply leadership to some of society's most complex problems. And I believe in the values that I hold. They're not my values. They're America's values. I believe in them, and I believe in my ability to stay true to them. And I also believe in a leader's ability to get things accomplished. I think everything rises and falls on leadership, and really more than anything, those are the things that drove my decision.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we get back, I want to talk to you about your decision to seek the nomination on the Republican side to run for governor. I want to talk to you about the thought processes that you went through and why you did it, and frankly, just a little in depth about why you're running. So we'll do that when we get back. You're listening to the Michael Brown Show. Mike Kopp in the studio with us. We'll take a quick break, then we'll be right back. Hey, welcome back to the Michael Brown Show. Glad to have you with me. We're doing our gubernatorial candidate interviews this week. Mike Kopp in the studio today. Mike, welcome back. Glad to have you.
I'm so glad to be here.
Thank you.
So explain to me, there's always something goes wrong in the brain, and at some point you decide, and I don't know, I'd like to know, like, what was that defining moment or what happened at that point, where you said to yourself, I'm going to run for governor of the state of Colorado. When and why did that happen?
Well, it happened over, a number of years. I served in the Senate. I was elected in 2006, so that's really where the story began for me. I got involved in a Senate primary. I had my own party largely working against me, and including our sitting governor, who has since become a friend. And, I overcame those odds. I won at the assembly by just a few votes, kept my opponent off the ballot. I turned around and won in the primary, too, by about 80 votes. I was outspent 6-1 in the primary, outspent 10-1 in the general election. So I served in the state Senate, and after my first year, I became the Republican caucus chairman, and by the end of my first term, I had been elected as minority leader. And I guess I began to learn that I had some things to offer to conservatives by way of leadership. And then I was reelected in 2010 to the Senate, and then I was reelected as a minority leader. Then I advanced a conservative agenda as a leader, and what I did was I focused on advancing reforms that everybody in my caucus, whether they agreed with me on issue A, B, or C or not, could get behind. And I just believe that it was critical to have a unified front around conservative principles and values. And I believe in the power of leadership. I do, truly. And I believe that the job of a leader is to empower people. It's not to build up their own prestige. It's not to build up anything for themselves. That's where I come from on it. And I began to ask the question, does it make sense for me to get into this race? Is this something that is just a flight of fancy? Do other people think this is a good idea? And so obviously the first person that I talked to about it was my wife, and we mulled it over for many, many months. And, as newlyweds, quite candidly, we went back and forth many times about it. Should we just focus on camping and spending time together or not? And really, we came to the conclusion that there's no such thing as pregame in life. And you can sit there and you can wait it out and watch opportunities to lead and do something useful pass you by, and play it safe if you want to. I believe I have been given the ability to lead others, and that's nothing that I have to claim on my own. My peers, when I left the Senate, saw that. My peers elected me twice in the Senate. When I served in ministry leadership, I had an opportunity to really be elevated to a national place within my denomination, and then later within a large organization that does leadership development around. So I guess what I'm trying to say is I've learned to lead in various environments and in complex ones. I think ministry work is very complex. I think political work is complex. I'm currently in senior management of an electric utility, and our work is complex work there. although my span of leadership is smaller than it has been at other times in life. But Michael, I think leadership matters. I think everything rises and falls on leadership. And I made the point earlier that I trust my values, that they're American values. And I think the most fundamental American value that a leader should grab a hold of is that people are supposed to be free. And if you're going to get in if you're going to get involved in government, your job is to make them more free. You know, Lincoln had this great phrase. He talked about a rebirth of freedom. And that's mostly what I'm interested in. That's what animates me. And I've just seen that I've had success in doing it.
So let me ask you, in terms of Colorado state government, what does that mean practically for a listener? How are you going to make the guy that's driving the Frito-Lay truck today, how do you make the guy that's working the convenience store over here, or for that matter, how do you make the doctor or the lawyer or anybody else, how does Colorado state government let them be more free? How would you go about doing that?
Well, I have been advocating a plan ever since October when I got into the race. My plan hasn't changed. My opponents has continued to morph, and I suppose maybe there's...
Is this your leaner?
That's part of it, yeah. Part of it? But I view the job of the government, or the governor, is to empower individuals and not government. And it's one thing to have that as a slogan, but it's another thing to have a plan that actually helps you accomplish that. So I focused on four key areas. One is on lower tax and spending policy. That's the reason that I went after a tax cut as a minority leader. Actually, I wasn't minority leader yet. As a member of the minority, I got a $10 million tax cut passed and signed into law. It's not an easy thing to do in this legislature. I advanced the bill called Blueprint for a Leaner Government, and that is aimed at doing two things: driving down the cost, size, complexity of state government. You have to have a plan, a program. You can't just talk about doing it. You got to have a system and a process to do it. I developed that.
So let me hold you there for a second. So you firmly believe, and I'd like to hear even just some details, but you firmly believe that government doesn't necessarily have to be on a continuing growth path of ever-increasing revenues, ever-increasing expenditures. You actually believe that government can be cut?
I believe, yeah, absolutely. It takes leadership.
Well, the reason I'm cynical is, I mean, 6 years in Washington, D.C., yeah, and interviewing hundreds of candidates, everybody talks that game. I never see it.
No. Ronald Reagan embarked on that crusade back in the 80s and had some success doing it. Even he didn't get as far as he wanted to get. People will follow a leader, and people will follow if you have vision. But to get to your question, how does it help the man driving the Frito-Lay truck? Our government puts barriers and hindrances in front of people on a daily basis. New barriers, new hindrances. Look at Obamacare. Look at the Second Amendment. Gun grabs that they did last year, just to name two. You could go on and on and on. When they do that, it's not just about giving you a new inconvenience in life. They're taking your freedom away. They're taking your liberty away. When they reduce the number of choices that you have for you and your family, they are taking your freedom. And so you can do one of two things. You can ignore it and just accept that this is the new norm. And I fear that a lot of Americans and Coloradans have, and just kind of assume that we're in for bigger government and more government. But I don't think it has to be that way. It hasn't always been that way. But it takes a plan, leadership, drive, and determination to peel these things back so that people can be more free and prosperous.
Okay, hang on. When we get back, I got a couple of more specific questions about how you would go about doing that, because we've got, I told you there's a headline right now on Complete Colorado. 93 inmates apply for expanded Medicaid via Obamacare. Seriously? That's taking away the Frito-Lay guy's freedom.
Absolutely.
Hey, welcome back to the Michael Brown Show. During our gubernatorial candidate interviews, Mike Kopp has, for whatever reason, agreed to appear on the show, and he's sitting over here, sitting next to me. Mike, I want to ask you this question. So you talk about the liberty and the freedom of the individual Coloradan, how we've got to make life for them more free. But specifically, what would you do? I mean, I think that, I asked you this before. Do we just have to accept that government's always going to grow larger? Can we actually cut government?
I think we have to. I think it's an obligation of the next governor to move in this direction. And it's not for the sake of carrying forward a Republican talking point. fundamentally, low taxes and smaller government is about liberty. It's about freedom. Right. It's about individual choice. So, but you have to have a vision to do that. And so I think you can. I think there, you know, it's not going to be an easy road, but the things I talk about a lot that I mean that the governor can do and I will do, one is you can appoint strict constructionist judges to the bench so that when attacks on the taxpayer bill of rights come before the judiciary, the taxpayers and the constitution-loving Coloradans win. And the other thing you can do is you can drive a low tax agenda from day one as governor. You know, the legislature obviously writes the legislation, but the governor gets to veto any bad bills that he doesn't want to see move forward. I've never seen our governor lead from the standpoint of saying, send these kinds of bills that drive up the cost of doing government, and I'm going to veto that bill. But I think that's where we are as a state, and I think that's what is needed. It's a commitment I'll make.
This is probably too generic of a question, but I'm going to ask it anyway and see what your response is. Let's say that you get elected governor, and you have a Republican-controlled legislature. I've seen way too many Republicans that when they get in power, they then fall into the same routine. Well, we need this program. We need this tax. Maybe they might even hold the limit on taxes for a while, but they want to spend money because they find spending money gives them power and influence. Would you be willing, or would you commit that if you are governor, even if you have a Republican-controlled legislature, that increases in taxes, increases in spending would be vetoed by you?
Yes, they would be vetoed. And here's what I would do, Michael. From day one, and now I give specific numbers when I'm campaigning. If you'll give me a moment later, I'll speak about what I want to do with our regulations here in the state to make people more prosperous. But on day one, the governor gets to set an agenda. He gets to set a tone, and you can make that as specific or as generic as you want. Mine would be specific. I would use that kind of language. Send these bills to me. I will veto them. The governor, if the governor doesn't put himself out there and be accountable from day one, then everything is just gray and you have all kinds of wiggle room. I'm not interested in it, really. I think that you have to be able to put yourself out there so that you're held to account for the very things that you said on day one and on the campaign trail too. So you have to hold Republicans to account for that. I was known as somebody in the Senate that actually did do that. You know, I was in a peculiar situation as the minority leader in the Senate. Here we had a Republican House, but we had a democratically controlled Senate. You know, the job of the minority leader in the Senate is, in some ways, to keep the House Republicans honest, because it's easier from the standpoint of the minority to drive, you know, sure, a very conservative
right
agenda.
Right.
But at the same time, there are things you have to do to actually govern. That was basically the role that I had. And so the speaker at the time, which was Frank McNulty, and he and I had lots of behind closed doors sort of shouting matches over our differing roles. But I do believe that at the end of the day, you have to hold political leaders accountable. And the only way you can do that is if they give their message clearly from the start, what you intend to do, not just in generic terms, but in specific terms. That's why I mentioned those things that I just mentioned to you about the vetoes and so forth. On the side of regulation, though, I firmly believe bad regulations aren't just a nuisance. They kill jobs. They
right
keep people
right
out of the job force. They keep employers from giving pay raises. And what they really do is they keep people into these kind of entitlement holding tanks, because there's so much pressure on job creators that they're not hiring people like they otherwise would. So my plan is a two-year plan. You asked about if I had a Republican House and a Senate. Well, on day one, I would initiate the blueprint for a leaner government. Part of that needs to take place from the executive branch. Part of it needs to take place from the legislative branch. But in 2 years, my aim is to bring industry leaders in, industry by industry, until we cover the whole every regulated industry in the state. And we bring the leader in and we say, tell us where we save you 25% on your cost of being a regulated business. We want to get there. That's our goal. That's our objective. I put that out everywhere I go, on every speech I give, on radio shows like this. I do that for a reason. I realize the peril if we don't succeed. But I'd rather fall short and get 18% than play it safe like Governor Hickenlooper has and said, I'm going to cut red tape. Then that can mean anything that you want it to mean. I want people to go back to work. I want kids that are coming out of college to actually have jobs to look forward to. So it can be done. I actually cut regulations from the standpoint of the minority, even not nearly as deeply as I would have liked. But this is a process whose time has come, and I'm ready to lead on it.
Do you think that education is one of those programs, just to put it in a category, that constantly needs increased funding, or do you think that there is a way to encourage local school districts to be more efficient with what they have? Or should we just, I guess, let me ask it my cynical way. Are you the typical politician that just says education is so important and we all just keep spending more and more money on education and we never focus on being more efficient with the dollars that we do spend on education?
I don't think that more money necessarily means better results. And oftentimes it does not mean better results. You know, you take an average student in the state, it's going to get over $7,000 at least per student. You take that times 25 or 30, depending on the class size. You're talking about a couple of hundred of thousands, you know, a couple hundred thousand dollars per classroom. I just have to believe that we can drive superior results in that classroom for that kind of money. That's actually on the low end too. So, no, I think we can have both. I think business owners know this. You know, everybody in their family budgets, they know this too. You have to accomplish certain things with what the resources that you have, and that's the end of the story. You know, you started out the interview discussing my background. I learned one thing principally as a young guy going through Ranger School, and that is you have the mission. That's it. Yeah, we know you've only slept for 2 hours each night for the last 16 nights. So what? You have the mission. And that mentality has really embedded itself in me because I went through some very difficult times during my service there and saw you can get through these hard times and you can accomplish the mission, all these excuses notwithstanding. I think the cream rises to the top. I think that good leaders can accomplish great results. There's a fantastic leader out on the western part of the state in Tim Foster who leads Mesa State University. It's like a brand new campus, and he's taking with fairly limited resources, and he's creating superior results out there. And when I talked to Tim, I said, why? And he said, it's leadership. Give us a little bit of money and get out of our way.
Very good. Hang on. I got a few more questions for you when we get back. Let's talk about some actual practicality of electoral politics. It's the Michael Brown Show, Mike Kopp in the studio. Hang on, folks. We'll be right back. Hey, welcome back to the Michael Brown Show. We're doing our gubernatorial candidate interviews. Mike Kopp's in the studio with me. Mike, would you support, if it was revenue neutral, would you support repeal the Colorado income tax and just go to a sales tax?
I'm generally in support of that. It'd have to be revenue neutral.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
I think a sales tax is a pretty good.
You okay with fracking?
Yeah, I love fracking. Fracking has opened up a lot of opportunity for people, and if we don't get in its way, it'll open up a lot more.
What's your position on the death penalty?
I would have signed the execution order on Nathan.
So you're not going to weasel on me if you get elected then?
No, I'm sorry to say that the governor didn't do that.
Do you understand what Common Core is?
I do.
For it, against it? What's your position?
I've taken a pretty strong position against Common Core. I do believe in having a state standard. I do believe in driving our kids to a very high standard. What has always made me nervous about Common Core is the fact that you've got a handful of education curriculum providers that are driving the bus on this. And, you know, and most recently now, I don't know if you saw the news over the weekend, but now SAT.
Oh, yeah, I did see that. Right.
Yeah, they're tying their program to Common Core. And that really puts all states in that aren't pleased with the direction, you know, that the broader conversation around Common Core is going. It puts them in a real bind.
I know this is a stupid question because I assume everybody's answer would be yes, but do you believe in the 10th Amendment?
In the 10th Amendment? not only that, but I have fought for the 10th Amendment. I actually have promoted an Article 5 Constitution around asking Congress to open up a convention for the purpose of amending the Constitution for a balanced budget amendment. And I'm also the only candidate, not that that's specifically a 10th Amendment thing,
sure.
but it's a state's
right.
Initiative thing. But I've also, I'm the only candidate in the race that has aggressively taken the fight to Obamacare from the standpoint of a state lawmaker. I was on the phone. This was 3 years ago when Obamacare passed. I was on the phone with leaders in Florida and Arizona. I had a bill that was ready to go that would have opted us out of Obamacare through a multi-state compact. I was driving that agenda, and I think we need to continue to drive that agenda. And people say it'll wind up in the courts. Great. Who cares?
Right.
We need to, that, you know, that's why the courts are there, to decide these things, and hopefully we win, but we got to fight that fight.
What's going to happen when the subsidy kicks out and all the Medicaid costs fall on Colorado taxpayers? What's going to happen at that point?
Well, that's exactly right. And that's the first reason why you need to go after that at a federal level. You need to go out and you need to find states of like mind. My opinion on this matter, Michael, is that the federal government is winning and freedom is losing around the country for the specific fact that the federal government is able to manipulate us into adopting the policies they want through our own money. So they'll say, you get this Medicaid money, but with these strings attached. Well, it's our money in the first place. You get this transportation money, but with these strings attached. So I believe that the new model needs to be this. I think that states have to align themselves 15, 20, 25 wide in these multi-state compacts and create significant political force, countervailing force against Washington. I don't see another way around it. I want my Congress to work, but it hasn't been working for us. And if we keep doing what we've always been doing, we're going to keep getting what we've already got.
Do you support right-to-work laws?
Absolutely.
And I assume that, actually, I'm not going to say anything, but you're a ranger. I still have to ask the question, which seems so stupid. What's your position on the Second Amendment?
I think in a lot of ways I've lived the Second Amendment. My dad taught me to defend my home when I must have been 9 or 10 years old. He showed me how to load a gun. He showed me where to hide. He showed me what to do. And a lot of people might find that surprising, but I was a real young kid. I grew up in that kind of household. I just think in America, you ought to be able to defend yourself if you're under attack. And you shouldn't have to just hope you can find a good place to hide.
What makes, we've got, if I don't look at my list, I'll forget somebody's name. We've got you, Brophy, Gessler, Tancredo, House, Beaupre, and I think even a few others out there on the periphery that are running for governor. What makes you think you can win?
You know, I have, I'm one of the few people.
I may be specific. What makes you think you can win the primary? I'm sorry.
I'm one of the few people in the race that has won a very, very difficult primary. Outspent 6-1, as I said. This is a statewide race, not a part of a county race like I had before, but the principle is the same. I won that race because I mobilized leadership. I focused on leadership. I focused on finding people to help me lead to get the job done. That's why we won the primary. That's why, even though I was outspent 10-1 then in a disastrous year, which was 2006, by the Democrat I was outspent, I also mobilized enough leaders around my district to win that general election. I think it is all about mobilizing leaders that can go out and get your message for you. What I've seen is this, Michael. I've seen that when we can get people to focus, we were discussing this earlier, when we can get people to focus on the candidates in this race, what they bring to the table, what their background is, and what they want to do moving forward, I think I stand out from the standpoint of being able to say, you don't have to talk about what I'm going to do, just look at my record. These are the things that I've done. And I think a person's the best predictor of somebody's future is what they've been doing in the past. I've been leading in the past, leading successfully in the past, and I'm going to make that case around the state. So far, it's working. You know, I'm up against three guys that have run statewide, in Beaupre and Tancredo and Scott Gessler. And what I see on the ground on a day-to-day basis is us making advances into the ranks of the grassroots, even though people may know those other guys a little bit better, all friends of mine, but all I hope will turn around and help me win the general election after I beat him in the primary.
And assuming that it's not you, but it's one of those, so I want to discount like a Dan Mays debacle again, but assuming that it's a Brophy, a Gessler, a House, Tancredo, a Beaupre that wins the primary, will you support them in the general election?
Absolutely.
And we've only got, I'm sorry, we're down to like 30 seconds, but any last things that you want to say to the listeners?
I think leadership matters. I think a person's record of accomplishment matters. I'd ask people to take a look at coloradoforcop.com. Last name's spelled K-O-P-P, coloradoforcop.com. Do your shopping, do your homework. If I'm your guy,
do your shopping. I love that.
I hope you'll let me know about it. And I would love the opportunity to defend freedom as your governor.
Mike, thanks for coming in. I appreciate you taking the time out to do this.
Thank you, Michael.
It's the Michael Brown Show. We'll take a quick break for news, and then I'll be right back with some comments. Hang on. Don't go away.